This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Some Bloomington aldermen want a signal from Normal whether that council would agree to a welcoming cities ordinance. How does town staff feel?
I don't support it. I think it's bad public policy to suggest that under no circumstances will we deal with another federal agency.
Hear Normal City Manager Mark Peterson talk about the downside of welcoming cities. Plus, hear from the mother of the first person in McLean County to die of an overdose from the synthetic drug carfentanil, and bullying bosses in the workplace.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The mother of the first person who died from an accidental heroin overdose involving the powerful synthetic opioid carfentanil says she wants to find meaning in her son's death, and that means sharing his story so other addicts get help. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talks with Ricky Lee Beneke. Her 23-year-old son Keegan died November 3rd, even as he was making plans for the future, including taking classes to become a sign language interpreter. Beneke talks about when she realized Keegan had a real problem.
Well, I mean, I know looking back, I felt like most teenagers, he did experiment with different things, and he was open with me about experimenting, but I never thought of it as an addiction. It's just something that high schoolers and young adults may do. So it was probably wasn't until about, spring of early summer of this year that I really noticed and thought that he had severe addiction issues, I guess, is when he had to enter inpatient rehab for it.
What made you realize this is a crisis situation?
Well, it was a blow up, actually. It was a crisis situation, and the fact that the crisis team had to be called, and he went to the emergency room, and a bed was found for him, and he willingly went. He admitted he did have a problem, and so I naively thought by him going through rehab, everything would be fine after that, and I found out later it wasn't.
Well, let's go back again to when Keegan was a teenager. He also had some mental health issues that started emerging.
Yes, he went through, was diagnosed as having severe depression and anxiety at an early age in high school, and was put on different prescription medications at that time, things that he didn't like how it made him feel, so he did not use them, and he's kind of always went through that and struggled with the fact that he did have depression, anxiety, and later was diagnosed bipolar. And it was very hard for him to accept that he had these mental health issues and disabilities, really, that needed medication. And he told me later he didn't want to take the medications after he admitted being an addict and did not like having to depend on something, even though mental health issues are completely different, you know, and taking the medication as prescribed rather than being an addict and taking illegal drugs.
So as a teenager, around what age did you first start realizing that these mental health symptoms were showing themselves?
Probably freshman year of high school, I would say, really, maybe sophomore.
So he's about 12 or 13?
Oh, probably 14.
Okay. And when you caught him drinking or whatever was occurring then, did you put anything together like, oh, maybe he's self-medicating?
I really did not think of that connection at the time. It was basically just sitting down with him as a mother, talking to her son and explaining, you know, the reasons why he shouldn't drink or smoke any type of illegal drugs and having that conversation with him. It really did not occur to me that he had any type of addiction problem at that point.
Well, your family's had a lot of tragedy, and we probably should address the one that people might be familiar with when they realize that you were married to Jeff Pilo, who ended up going away to prison for being a serial rapist. How do you think that might have impacted what was going on with Keegan at the time? Help us with the time frame.
Keegan was very young when this first happened. He was probably, I wanted to say, around 11 or 12 when his father was first arrested. And like any young child that age, not having a father in his life throughout the high school years, I'm sure, and from our conversations, I know it did impact him greatly. And Keegan and I, did have a very good relationship. We could talk a lot about it, but there were certain things that I know he talked to other people more, things that he couldn't tell his mom or didn't want to tell his mom, didn't want to hurt me. And so not having a father in his life, of course, did affect him, but that's not what caused the addiction. Addiction is something that I've learned a lot about very quickly over the past year. And it's, you know, these things that occur, tragedies in people's lives, not having your father around, certainly cause pain and trauma. People want to numb themselves from the pain. So while it kind of goes hand in hand, one did not cause the other. Addiction is really a disease. It is very much a part of a person's physiological self, and it's very hard to fight through and go through the steps and being able to stay sober. And so I think that's what I learned I was wrong about, was that when Keegan went through rehab, I really felt that, okay, everything's going to be better now. Like, the addiction was cured. And addiction, like a lot of diseases, is not something that can be cured. It's always there. So different struggles that come up play into having that urge for one more fix.
There are triggers.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
So when your ex-husband, Jeff Pilo, was sentenced to prison, you made some decisions to move, right?
We moved right around that time frame. You'll have to forgive my memory is a little foggy for that time frame. It was not a very happy point in any of our lives. And we did move around quite often, actually, and ended up coming back to Illinois about 8 years ago, I think.
But Keegan finished high school in Indiana.
And he actually finished high school here in Illinois. We moved back and he graduated from El Paso Gridley High School.
One other piece of that time frame was you had an evolution about the guilt or innocence of your husband at the time, and not everybody in the family followed suit.
We all had our differences of opinions, and I let the kids choose to think what they wanted. They knew that the reasons I did divorce their dad, but I left it up to them. I mean, he's their father. I know he loved them and they love him, and it was up to them to continue the relationship with their dad. Just like any other couple that goes through a divorce, I don't mean to tear away their father. Their father has already been torn away from them. It's just that I chose to no longer be married to him. And although there was some friction at the time, all of the kids really eventually understood why I did what I did and the reasons behind it, even though they might not have been happy with it at the time.
I'm Colleen Reynolds. This is Sound Ideas, and we're talking with Ricky Lee Beneke, whose 23-year-old son Keegan had an accidental overdose in November, and Keegan was the first who had a combination of heroin and carfentanil, which is the most lethal ingredient that is being mixed nowadays with heroin. Part of the reason you're talking to us is you really want people to understand a couple of things: the power of addiction and really putting out the warning of the danger of what is out there and available in Bloomington Normal. You really didn't know.
No, I didn't. I had no idea. A lot of people think, first of all, when you talk about heroin, they, at least in my mind, I pictured the stereotypical heroin user, maybe some homeless person shooting up. And that is not the case at all. I'm finding out that heroin can be used in many different forms. I've learned out later that Keegan actually snorted the heroin and he kept it very well hidden from me. He did not, I don't think, use it that often because he did not appear to be intoxicated very often around me either. It was very rare that I saw this, especially after him going through Chestnut. But in the couple of months leading up to his death, I noticed a couple of times where he seemed maybe a little different. And when I confronted him about it, he promised he wasn't using anything. So I still believed him. I thought he's an adult. He would tell me if he needs help. I told him again to make sure that he talked to his counselor, and I'm here if he ever wanted to talk about it. The reason that I really want the awareness is actually for Keegan, because he really cared about helping others. He really wanted to be sober. He really tried to go through the steps of being sober, and he was really trying to make a difference in his life and had plans for the future. He was going to go back to school and become a sign language interpreter and just all sorts of dreams that he had. But because the addiction, the disease that had a hold of him, I'm sure caused him to not tell me the full truth because he didn't want to hurt me. He didn't want me to think any less of him.
We know that coroner classified his death as an accidental overdose. You knew that immediately because...
I'm the one that found him, yes. And actually, he had literally looked like he had stood up from the kitchen table and was going to go to bed and just fell over the kitchen table, and that's where I found him. I also found later a note on the counter, which scared me at first, but then I read the note and he had written a note to me saying, asking if he could borrow my car the next day so that he could go to the gym and work out. So he had a lot of things planned, a lot of things ahead of him, even for the next day. I just hope that somehow this warning or that his death will mean something to somebody else to help them realize that there are so many dangers out there. Keegan told me once that heroin was easier to get a hold of in this town than marijuana even was, which completely took me by surprise. But I think the thing that I'm trying to do is to make sure that people are aware that if you have an addiction, there is help available to try to get that help, because you don't know what you're getting. You don't know what your heroin or your cocaine or any of the other drugs could be mixed with. And the pain that it's caused me to find my son like that, the pain it's caused his entire family and all of his friends, his nieces and nephews who adored their Uncle Keegan, that is not something he would have wanted. That is not something any family should have to go through. There is help. Just try to reach out, or if you're a family member and you notice these things, try to encourage to get help. Just, I mean, it's very much to me like playing a game of Russian roulette, because you have no idea what is being mixed in these things. Very much lethal.
Well, and you must still have some anxiety because you have a daughter who also has struggled with addiction. You must still be worried at some level.
I am. Shayla's been very much going through recovery and she's doing quite well. And now I know, and I think that's why I worry even more, is because addiction is always there. It's never going to be cured. But I think from our talks that we've had, I'm hoping that the loss of her brother and seeing what it did will help deter maybe those times when the addiction wants to take hold and she wants to use. But she'll think about her brother, she'll think about the rest of the family, and she'll think about how she feels and not use and continue to get the help that she is getting.
So as we wrap this up, Ricky Lee, is there any other advice that you would have for parents who are worried about their own children?
If you're worried about your own children, or see any signs that you think are any type of drug use, I encourage talking. Keegan and I talked a lot, and I found out different things as we talked. Encourage them to get help, but also know that if you're thinking, well, this would never happen to me, this, you know, my child would never do that, addiction is something that, you know, there's no set, economic class, ethnicity. I mean, it doesn't discriminate. It goes across all the lines. Addiction is truly a disease, but you can get the help to overcome that. And I would encourage the parents to really seek out the help, even if it's just for themselves, to know what the resources are and not give up. And not, you know, if you're questioning, if you're wondering, have that conversation.
What about, you know, families who have children who come home and maybe they've been drinking, or it seems like maybe they were smoking pot? Is there a stronger reaction that they should have now than maybe back when you were a teenager?
I really don't know. I mean, alcohol can be just as addicting as heroin or cocaine. Prescription pills can be addicting. I mean, there's so many different types of addiction out there. I think the best thing to do would to be talking to someone who really understands or knows a professional to see what kind of resources are available out there. Calling PATH, for example, to get those resources, to be able to fully understand what's going on.
We're hearing a lot about the opioid crisis. With Keegan, did it start out with painkillers and then move to heroin?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. He really told me that I didn't want to know all of the types of drugs he experimented with. And I naively and very much did not press the issue. And I wish now I would have pressed that issue, looking back.
Was that at the time you went into rehab?
That was shortly before the crisis situation, before rehab.
And with your daughter, do you know what were opioids, or have they been a factor with her?
They used to, yes, definitely. It's so prevalent, it's so available. And I think that's something that we need to work on to change, especially now that deadly materials are being mixed in with them.
Ricky Lee, is there anything else we haven't covered or talked about that you wanted to share?
If you're concerned about your family member, listen to those concerns. Don't dismiss them simply because the person that you love told you everything's fine. If you have those concerns, try to reach out and really get help, look for help, or encourage them to get help. I wish I would have pressed more instead of simply taking his word that everything was fine when it obviously wasn't.
Ricky Lee Beneke speaking with GLT's correspondent Colleen Reynolds.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Brian Bloodworth's part two of his examination of ISU football. As advocates push for a welcoming city ordinance in Bloomington, both Normal and Bloomington city managers are expressing concern about the law that would prohibit police from cooperating with federal law enforcement on deportation efforts. Town of Normal city manager Mark Peterson questions the need for such an ordinance. Interim Bloomington city manager Steve Rasmussen is concerned any law on the books needs to be enforced. Bloomington is also waiting to see what Normal may develop so the two ordinances or resolutions are the same on both sides of Division Street. Rasmussen indicates there's a lot of public interest in a welcoming city ordinance.
We had that meeting at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts because we anticipated getting more people than could be accommodated in the council chambers, and that was true. We had about 350 people there. The public comment went well over the normal half an hour, and the council made a motion to extend that, so it extended to about an hour and a half's worth of discussion, and as a result of that, there was some discussion about bringing back something to the council again, and so the city attorney has drafted up what he would propose, a new kind of language on that ordinance, which we would put out for people to discuss. Now, where the council may move on that and when they want to move, I'm not sure. We've sent this out to them, and we've asked where they would like to go with that, and I think that's where we are now. We're waiting to hear what they would like to do.
And some of those language changes would address some concerns that Chief Hefner had regarding how they would cooperate with federal law enforcement.
I think so, and the police chief had certainly has some interest, mostly as concerns crime prevention. That's what we're interested in doing. We don't want to do anything that would tie the hands in the police's hands in terms of crime prevention.
You also don't want to frighten the immigrant community thinking they're going to be picked up, so they don't report crime, though, either. So it is a line that this ordinance would walk.
Well, I think I wouldn't want to comment on that until we had a chance to take a look at what some draft language have and what the council might want to work on that. I think we'd be speculating until we have a chance for them to comment on it.
Have the groups, Mark, that have been advocating for this in Bloomington spoken with you or elected officials in Normal?
I haven't spoken with me. I can't speak for some of the council members and the mayor. They may have some conversations, but certainly there hasn't been nearly the level of dialogue that you've seen in Bloomington in our community. I think they're waiting, and once there's maybe some resolution in Bloomington, we suspect they'll knock on our door. But we also are acknowledging the fact that the city has, some of the members of the council said, we'd like to know where Normal stands on this. And so I do know that Mayor Coos has been actively discussing this privately, individually with members of his council. They've shared the ordinance with the police department and myself, and so I do think they want to be in a position to be able to give some indication to the city in the fairly near future of where we stand on it. I will be candid with you. I've reviewed the ordinance. I've talked to our legal department, our police department. I don't support it. I think it's bad public policy to suggest that under no circumstances will we deal with another federal agency. I can tell you, as a matter of course, we don't. We typically don't deal with immigration officials. It's rare. They don't call us. We don't call them. If they call us for help, it would have to be very specific and necessary circumstances for us to provide them a support. So really, there is virtually right now no collaboration with federal immigration officials. But we can't, there may be a situation out there that it's in our best interest to cooperate. And I think it's like I say, short-sighted and bad policy to say never. I also don't, I'm personally a little confused as to what is the problem we're trying to address. Is it a potential problem that could exist, or is it a real problem that exists today? But and the council has asked, I mean, privately, where is the staff? And we, I think, like the chief Hefner in Bloomington, we don't support it because of some problematic issues in the ordinance.
Do you acknowledge that the political rhetoric might have in this country has caused some people in the immigrant community to be concerned about this kind of thing?
Absolutely.
Even false detentions.
Absolutely. We understand there's concern about it. We understand. But again, right now, we can tell people we are not working with federal immigration officials, but we also don't want to suggest that we never will, and under no circumstance will we. There may be instances where it's in our best interest.
Human trafficking cases, for instance.
Certainly. Things like that. So But we understand the reason. We understand the concerns. We're certainly sympathetic to the cause. But when you talk about putting law on the books, a law is a law, and
have to enforce it.
We have to enforce it, and we have to understand the ramifications of that law. And the way I look at this ordinance as drafted, it has some ramifications that are. Police chief and myself are uncomfortable with at this point.
Do you think in Bloomington, Steve, that what you end up with might be so milquetoast or toothless that it's pointless?
Well, I don't know. My opinion, my personal opinion on it is you can't put together an ordinance that's going to keep everybody happy. Either side is going to want it to be more stringent on their side than the other side, and so that makes it very, very difficult to craft something that walks the middle ground. I would like to comment on what Mark said and the two things he said in the same order he did. First of all, about the elected officials, I know we have elected officials who would like to say that we would like to see what Normal is doing because we would like to have whatever the policy here is to be a policy as a community. There's not a different it's not different for when you go across Division Street. The community all ought to try to treat this in the same thing. And I know we have elected officials officials who would like to do that. The second thing, in terms of the police department, we also do not go out and specifically enforce any immigration policies. What our policy is that we are involved in crime prevention and public safety. And if something comes out that has to do that is incidental or related to the commission of a crime, it may come out. But that's not what we're out there to do. We're out there to prevent the crime.
It sounds as though Bloomington may still be waiting for what normal might do. Mm-hmm. Is this an opportunity for the Corporation Council for the city, for the town of Normal, Brian Day, and the Corporation Council for the city of Bloomington, Jeff Juergens, to sit down and talk about what an ordinance might look like or a resolution might look like that would serve both communities?
I would say if that's ultimately the direction of the council, is we want to craft our own ordinance that maybe is a hybrid or a modification of what has been suggested, that would be an appropriate course of action. Of course, the attorneys they draft what they're told to draft, so they're still going to need some direction from probably the managers as well as the councils. But certainly at some point that might be appropriate. I don't know that we're ready to do that yet. I think first of all the decision needs to be made. Is it this ordinance? If not this ordinance, do we want to come up with a substitute or not? So I think there's some decisions that need to be made, and hopefully, I know there's a lot of people anxious for this to move forward. I think we are as well, because it is a bit distracting. It's important, but it is distracting, and I think the sooner a decision can be made, the better. But I also understand the city's wanting to be fairly deliberate and include all this input and understand we're normal. And I do think it makes sense for both of us to be kind of on the same page on this issue. So I suspect that Mayor Kuss will be communicating information back to Mayor Renner to let him know, here's what I'm hearing from my council, probably within the next couple of weeks. And so they will have benefit of at least what we're thinking on this end before they actually move forward with some sort of action.
Yeah, I feel confident that those conversations are going to take place. And from the elected officials that I've talked to, I know they want to do that. The only thing that I can tell you that is for certain is that what took place at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts on December 18th, and that was that the council chose not to take action and that they did ask the corporate council to keep working on a proposed ordinance that might work together, and I know he is doing that, and so he has that now. And given that, where the elected officials may choose to go with that is going to probably be as a result of much of the conversation that they're probably going to have this coming.
Interim Bloomington City Manager Steve Rasmussen and Town Manager Mark Peterson speaking with GLT's Mike McCurdy.
Support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable and timely financial management with a contemporary independent perspective. Zimmerman and Armstrong have been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, bullying bosses in the workplace. When Brock Spack signed on as head coach at Illinois State University 9 years ago, he said he was in it for the long haul. GLT's Brian Bloodworth talked with Spack in his office recently and about his coaching future, the past season, and what needs to happen in this offseason to get the program back in the FCS playoffs. Spack says he wants to end his career at ISU.
Yeah, I hope to. I hope everybody lets me. Yeah, I'd love to. You know, my football career started on a football field in Illinois. I'd love for it to end there. On a football field in Illinois. Always thought that this would be a great job. I watched it from a distance for a long, long, long time. And when it came open, I thought I came open before where I wasn't ready for that. You know, I didn't have a resume that would think, okay, this guy deserves to be a head coach in Division I football. I think that when I got this job, I had been through the wars. I'd been a coordinator for 14 years. I'd been in the Big Ten. I recruited, obviously all over the country, but I recruited the state of Illinois from here. You know, as an Illinois guy, I think this made sense from a lot of, it was a very good fit for me. It's been a very good fit for my family, and I hope that people think I'm a very good fit for, or we have been a very good fit for Illinois State, because, you know, I have had opportunities to leave, and I'm just not excited about that. You know, my wife and I really love it here. I keep telling people that, you know, this is our home, and we have, you know, put our heart and soul into this program, and you know, the family's here now, and Brent played here, and my daughter's part of the program now, and administration really wanted to get that to work. So it's just been a really good fit.
What about this past season? You missed making the playoffs for the first time in the last four seasons. How disappointing was that?
Very, very disappointing. And again, no one puts more pressure, at least on me, than me. Or on us than us. But that's good. You know, I think from last, you know, the bar, the expectations have been raised. But there's the expectations, no one can put higher expectations on us than us. And they can't.
Despite not making the FCF playoffs, SPAC doesn't want to take away from what the outgoing senior class brought to the program by compiling a 35-16 record in four seasons, winning two Missouri Valley Conference championships with many of the players on the 2014 team that played for the national championship.
I still want to recognize, you know, what guys have done here. I don't want our seniors to leave here and think, well, I left, you know, it wasn't quite the ending I wanted, but we've had, if we're in BCS football, we're bowl eligible 8 years out of nine. Think about that. We've been in eight bowl games. Okay, getting in the FCS playoffs is difficult. We had a team in 2011, maybe in our best team, didn't get in at 7-4. A team got in last year at 6-5 because of the win we had at Northwestern. You know, this year we didn't have that. I was very disappointed because I think that it was sitting right in front of us. We couldn't finish a game in South Dakota State. We couldn't finish a game here at home. You know, we didn't play well on the road at Southern Illinois. We had a 14-point lead that we blew against Western Illinois. So there were opportunities for us, even though we had parts of our team are very young and inexperienced. I get that, but this team, we had, you know, that's what made it disappointing. And so I think you have to manage disappointment, and you have to be able to manage the organization through disappointment. And now we've moved on through that into, hey, where are we going now? And this is where we're going now. It never changes here. It's always the next championship. We look at the leadership, you know, hard work ethic, toughness, all that stuff. We're going back at it.
SPAC said youth and inexperience hampered the Redbirds, but that necessarily didn't catch him off guard.
I worried about, you know, experience, and not I won't say youth is necessary, is experience at certain spots of our team. When I watched preseason, we played very well at times. Some of our strengths were taken away. You know, when you're not balanced, either offense and defense or in special teams, you don't have a balance. You know, if you're too heavy to one area, you know, a team can take that away from you. So I think that showed itself in some of the games down the stretch. I couldn't tell you, but I wouldn't be less than honest to think, yeah, I had concerns about experience, and there's no other way to get experience but to play through it, and that'll continue. I had some concerns, but I felt that, you know, parts of our team we could rely on our strengths and get to the playoffs, and once you get in the postseason out of this conference, anything can happen, that there were some concerns, yes.
We're talking with ISU football coach Brock Spack about the past season and what's ahead for the Redbirds on this edition of Sound Ideas. I'm Brian Bloodworth. Brock, what do the Redbirds need to happen to return to the playoffs?
We have to reestablish our identity on offense, I think, and even on defense in some regards. You know, there's some things we need to get better at to improve in our, I don't know if philosophy is the right word, but there's, you know, I think particularly offensively, we have to have an identity. You know, I didn't really, you know, 1 week we were really good here, and next week we weren't. You know, and just inconsistent. And but our identity, we need to reestablish our identity throughout the program, but particularly on offense. You know, I think that's going to be key. You got to score, unfortunately, in this time, in this era. A dominant defense cannot win just with a dominant defense. You can't be bad on defense to win, but you have to be able to score. And we have to become more explosive. At times we were, but the last two seasons we haven't been explosive. And that could be because maybe we don't have enough explosive players, but I think we're going to continue to develop. I think our players are good. I think we can improve that. We're continuing to improve that through recruiting. But we have to develop an explosive identity on offense. And so I think that's where we're at right now. It's pretty obvious, right?
So is it a personnel issue, do you feel?
Some, but not all. No. But some.
What are the areas that you focused on with this incoming
receivers,
recruiting class?
We need explosive receivers. Linemen are always going to have a group of linemen. You always got to develop your linemen. I like our depth on defense. You know, is always going to be an issue. You know, we're going to be young up front next year defensively, but there are some kids in the program that have shown promise and developing depth through recruiting. I think we need to, I think there's parts of our defense, played very, very well. All parts played very well at times. I think being a little more consistent, particularly in the back half, is important. We were a little, we got a little banged up back there this fall, just nagging stuff that, maybe to the naked eye or the casual fan didn't see. And that's part of it, but we have to be more consistent back there as well. More consistent on defense in certain scenarios. But establishing identity, I think our identity is pretty good on defense. But we can't lose games in special teams. We for the most part have been very good, but we've been there's some things that happened in games where we missed a kick that could have been crucial. We got a punt blocked, we got a kickoff punt returned, we've been pretty good, and I think really good most of the part, but inconsistent sometimes. You can't have catastrophic plays. In an offense, it's been an identity. Our identity here has been we've been a very good running team, play action pass, explosive receivers and tight ends. We got to get back to that again.
With four new assistant coaches on board, ISU coach Brock Spack says he can't wait to begin the process when spring practice begins in late March. You can also hear Brian Bloodworth's report on how ISU football came from a nothing tradition to contending. That's at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Millions of women responded to allegations of sexual harassment against figures in the entertainment industry, members of Congress, prominent journalists, through the hashtag MeToo. Workplace experts say another common problem affecting mostly women is workplace bullying. In a 2011 Harris Interactive poll, 34% of working women reported some form of workplace bullying. More than two-thirds of those incidents involved actions by male supervisors. Bullying can take the form of verbal abuse, humiliation, or sabotaging an employee's job performance. Workplace experts say women also face a double standard in terms of expectations. Illinois State University psychology professor Leandra Paris tells GLT's Judy Valente it's more difficult for women to find redress for these types of workplace problems.
So when we look at bullying, we have four different components that we're looking for. One is that it's intentional, so it's not something that just accidentally happened or that they didn't mean. It's something that's repeated, so it happens more than once, and it causes distress. So if the victim doesn't feel like they're being bullied, then we don't really count that. And then the other part that's really important and sort of heavily debated is that there's a power differential. So usually when we consider bullying, the perpetrator has some sort of physical or social power over the victim. So when we're looking at whether or not it's happening in the workplace, it's not uncommon for that to fall to the boss because they naturally have that power differential.
An interesting statistic that came out of the Workplace Bullying Institute is that the vast majority of bullying comes from your boss. It's a boss bullying an employee. What form does that take?
It can take a couple of different, I think, areas. One would be physical, so I'm assuming that this is probably not someone hitting or kicking their employees or they'd be fired. But usually it's more relational, so leaving them out, undermining them, lying about them, or verbal aggression, just calling them names or telling them that they're not doing a good job and psychologically trying to undermine their state.
Does this affect women more than men in your experience?
So what we know from the research is that women who observe others being bullied actually do physiologically and emotionally experience more distress than men do. So they are more likely, if they see it and experience it, to have sort of a weightier consequence.
Is part of the problem that in the vast majority of companies, the supervisors are going to be men and their, you know, their women employees will be targets?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things that happen. It's sort of an intersectionality between how men and women relate to each other, plus the power in the room. And so men who already have power, you add on the power of being the supervisor, and now you have this huge power differential that's going to put that woman at risk. And I think you can just as easily have a woman be a supervisor and be a bully. It kind of comes off differently. Part of that is because if there's a male who's an employee and the woman's trying to bully him, he can bully back. We see that often, that men can kind of bully back and it's okay. But if a woman does that, it's not.
Well, this gets to another item which women face in the workplace, and that's the double standard.
Mm-hmm.
A man who expresses a forceful opinion or point of view is a strong employee. A woman who does so is shrill or worse. I don't want to use the B word. Talk about that and the commonality of that.
You know, it's interesting. I read an article this morning that kind of, I think, helps explain a little bit of that. What we know is that men are more aggressive when they're showing any sort of emotion. And then for women, we are sort of socialized to be the quiet, submissive sort of type. And what we see is that men, even if they're not being socialized to be hostile as far as their sexism, there is this term of benevolent sexism, where they're taught that they're supposed to come in and save the woman, and she's the princess, she's a damsel in distress. And then there's a fine line between that, and she's supposed to be submissive, she does what you tell her to do because you're her protector. And that gets socialized very, very early on for both men and women. And research shows that men sort of internalize that. So if you hear that your entire life and then you go into the workplace, you're naturally going to do that. You're still going to be doing that. You're going to be coming in, you're going to be trying to save the women, or you're going to be trying to, you know, kind of undermine their power. Because when they then speak and go against that schema, it's a much bigger deal because you're not supposed to be the knight in shining armor. I am. And so that's where that comes from.
Why is it so difficult for men to accept a disagreement or a differing opinion from a woman, or interpret that as being somehow disrespectful on the part of the female employee, where they possibly would not have the same reaction to a man saying the exact same thing?
You know, I have run into this. And so I think it's a little, it causes a lot of emotionality in me, obviously. So I'll try to answer this without having that bleed in. But really, honestly, I don't, all I can tell is what I feel and what those of us who have experienced that kind of feel. And it's almost like, how dare you question my authority? How dare you question anything that I say, frankly? And then also just a sense of sort of embarrassment that there's this woman who sort of like came out, right, and stood up and maybe corrected them. And then if a man does it, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, punch each other's shoulders or whatever. But in my experience, those are actually few and far between as far as like outwardly being like, I don't agree with you. I think it's more likely in my experience to have where other people in the room accept what they say over me. So for example, I was in a situation where it was me and a colleague, and we're in a clinic, and the students were introducing us, and they introduced him as, you know, Dr. So-and-so, and then me as Leandra Paris. And it never even occurred to him. And then like later when it came up, he was mortified, and he was like, oh my gosh, I didn't even notice, I should have corrected that. And so I think it's not just the person standing next to you, the man, it's the women and the other men in the room who let it continue to happen.
Yeah, that's a good point that you make, because sometimes men may not know, male supervisors may not know how they come off to a woman. And, you know, is there anything that the woman can do to say without jeopardizing her job, you know, I didn't feel good when you said that to me, or I felt that was somewhat disrespectful. How can a woman then help a male supervisor to understand how he is coming off?
I think that gets tricky. So as one of the younger faculty and as, you know, not tenured, I'm very fortunate to have a relationship with most of the men in my life that I feel like I could go to them and be like, hey, you know, the student introduced you as Dr. So-and-so and not me. So, you know, let's talk about how that made me kind of feel. And I will say that has a happy ending. He went on to then introduce me as Dr. Leandra Paris everywhere we went. But I think you have to be careful when you have to think about why they're doing what they're doing. Was it unintentional? Because then it's not bullying, right? Going back to our definition. And then I think really just being honest with them and doing it without emotionality. So I know in all the research I've done, the minute you start to show any emotion, be it anger or sadness or happiness, that moment gets undermined. And so a woman has to be even more careful than men when they go to approach their boss to say something, to make sure they've practiced it and make sure that all that emotionality is taken out of the equation.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm here with Dr. Leandra Paris of the ISU Psychology Department. We're talking about the bullying that takes place of women beyond sexual harassment in the workplace. You mentioned your own personal experience. What other anecdotes or stories have you heard from women about bullying by a boss or the double standard, the quintessential double standard that women face?
Since working here and starting in academia, a lot of it is around maternity and being a mother. And I wasn't expecting that. And it wasn't just from men. It was from other women. And so I have a really hard time sort of being like, oh, it's all the men's fault, because there are so many times where I've been in a room and sexism was completely supported by the other women in the room.
In what way? Give me an example.
Right. For example, there are no sanitary napkin bins in the stalls in most of the bathrooms that I have been on in campus. So I went to my boss and I was like, hey, I would really like to have a bin inside the stall, which is best practice per OSHA regulations, to dispose of my sanitary napkins. And he was completely like, he was like, I had no idea. I mean, how would he? He doesn't go in the women's bathroom. And then I brought it up later to, you know, a mixed gender room. And the women were like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. And I was like, well, wait, like yesterday the trash can had been moved out by the elevator. So I had to take my sanitary napkin and throw it out by the elevator, which is an OSHA violation, by the way. And they were just like, oh, you know, you just have to deal with it. Like, it's, and I'm like, what planet are you on right now? And the men are looking at me like, I don't really know what to say about this. Like, do I have a right to say anything? And here was an example of like a really small, systematic, sexist thing that happens in multiple places, multiple workplaces. And the one time where I was basically saying, I feel more comfortable going to the bathroom in a dive bar because they have a sanitary napkin disposal bin, I expected the women, whether they are postmenopausal or not, to kind of say, yeah, you know what, that would be nice. And instead, I got the exact opposite.
Right. So it's you know, women can be a problem, too, in some of these issues. I have to ask you about what's happening at a nationwide level. We've had a female senator, U.S. senator, told by a male U.S. senator to just sit down and basically shut up. And women who have spoken up on other issues, especially on sexual harassment, then are attacked by their male colleagues. What do you see on the national level, and how do you think that's going to play out in individual lives of women?
Right. Well, I think it's hard to hold anyone accountable when the highest office in your country doesn't hold himself accountable for how he treats women. So
you're talking about Donald Trump.
Yeah. Trying to be diplomatic. And so that, I think, causes a narrative that allows that to happen and makes people think that it's okay, that we can now kind of tell women to sit down and shut up. And I think the other thing is that when we as women see that, and you look at the voter base, right? Like, no one hates a successful woman like a woman. And so I, at least I can speak for me and some of my other colleagues, when we hear about these senators being treated so poorly, is like, if they'll do that in public, what do they think of me face to face? And then what about the women who see it too and still go out and vote for these people? Still go out and say, yeah, he may have molested some kids, but that's fine. He can still be a senator. Like, I think we have to hold each other accountable. We spend so much time going on and on and on about the men in our lives who treat us poorly, but we don't really support each other. We don't jump on that bandwagon. And as far as individual lives, I know that with a lot of people coming out and people feeling like now is a safe time to come forward, there are also the other people who think, wow, it's really still not. So I just had a conversation 2 weeks ago with someone who was debating on whether or not to come forward about sexual harassment. And we literally did a pros and cons list. You know, you're going to be thrown through the mud. You're going to have, there's going to be this full investigation. And then there's, you know, and it may not come out to be anything that makes you feel satisfied. So women are still having to do all of this mental cognitive work just to determine whether or not it's safe to even say something. And that is something that I just don't see going away while we're allowing things like this to happen in a public forum.
Do you think things have improved a little bit since the Me Too revolution, so to speak, has taken place? Now, it's focused on sexual harassment, and what we're talking about is other forms of mm-hmm. harassment that's not sexual in the workplace by people in positions of power. Do you think there's been any improvement, or is it so many women are just afraid this too will pass and we'll go back to the old ways?
I've seen both. So I think in some ways, for me, it was enlightening to see everyone, you know, doing the hashtag Me Too, and I had no idea that that many of my friends had similar experience. None of us even talked about it. And so I think it opened up a dialogue that wasn't there before. But at the same time, I think there are plenty of people who were like, movements come and go. And we see them rise up and then they peter out. And so I think we just have to see, you know, with the Time article coming out, I think that will help. But we'll have to kind of see where it goes, because there are plenty of women who are like, I've been doing this battle for decades and haven't gotten anywhere. Why would this be any different?
You're talking about Time magazine choosing the Me Too women as mm-hmm. their people of the year.
Yeah.
Leandra Paris is a professor in the psychology department at Illinois State University. She's an expert on the area of bullying. Thanks so much for talking about all of this.
You're welcome.
I'm Judy Valente.
The magazine Psychology Today calls workplace bullying a silent epidemic. Studies have shown bullying is the most common among managers who are ill at ease in their supervisory roles. Researchers found this kind of behavior leads to increased levels of stress among employees, higher rates of absenteeism, and higher than normal attrition rates. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Mike McCurdy, Colleen Reynolds, Brian Bloodworth, and Judy Valente. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.